Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Brad Meltzer, who reads from and discusses his new book, The Book of Lies, published by Grand Central. In the weeks to come, we have Douglas Brown, Chuck Klosterman, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening and welcome to The Tattered Cover. Thank you for supporting your independent bookstore, and thank you for silencing your cell phones. The Book of Lies is based on two true stories that remain mysteries: the murder of Abel by his brother Cain, and the unsolved murder of Mitchell Siegel, whose son went on to create Superman. How could these two stories be related? Brad says this is a story he's been waiting his whole life to write. Please join me in welcoming the author of The Book of Lies, Brad Meltzer.
Only a loser, and this is the rule, the first rule of writing a novel, only a loser ever wears what they're wearing to their book signing to be the same outfit they're wearing in their author photo. I'll give you a moment to check your books, as I realize as I walk in here. What I'd love to talk about is obviously this book, The Book of Lies. And I want to talk about, first with a personal note, because I see some friends and some family here in the audience. And for those who don't know, my mom actually, when I started writing this book, was diagnosed with breast cancer. And I finished writing the book, and she finished reading the book as she passed from breast cancer. And my mom was this kind of person who, when we hit the bestseller list, I called her up and I said, Mom, we hit the bestseller list. And she starts crying. And when you hear your own mother crying, of course, you start getting all teared up. And now I'm worried that wherever she is, she's going to crash the car. So I'm like, Mom, where are you? And she says to me, I'm at Marshall's. And I'm like, of course she's at Marshall's, right? We hit the bestseller list, and she's still trying to find a deal on irregular socks. But it was my mother's greatest lesson, and that is to never, ever, ever, ever change for anybody. And what some of my friends in this audience know this story, but I want to give you the epilogue to the story. And the epilogue is that when my mom passed recently, Marshall's, this is true, knowing their greatest customer was gone, actually sent us a gift card in her honor and said to donate this to her, our favorite charity. And my sister said it best when she said, I don't know if Mom is happy right now or pissed she can't spend it. But what I do want to tell you about, and the reason I bring this up, is because this book is filled with my mother. And I wish I was better at hiding it, but it is no coincidence that that's why the main character is dealing with the loss of his mother. And it is why it's dedicated to my mother. And when you go through this book, it's amazing to me. You can just... I didn't even realize it. You know, you show me a novel and I'll show you what the author is dealing with at that moment. And I didn't even realize it until I was proofing the book and going through the final changes, and I just go, my gosh, it's not just a mention of breast cancer here or there. It's my mom is in this book. And I love that about this book. It's what makes this book very special to me. It's the reason why I don't want to sell it to Hollywood and it's not for sale, is because of that reason. So with that said, I want to tell you about The Book of Lies. The Book of Lies really began 11 years ago for me. And I just finished my first novel, The Tenth Justice. And now you have this moment where you have to go in and you have to tell your editor, here's the book I want to follow up with. Here's my next magic trick. It's a scary moment because you got to come up with a new magic trick. And I went and I said, I want to do a modern thriller. That was 11 years ago. I want to set it in modern day. It's a mystery. It's a thriller. But it's going to be filled with the real story of Cain and Abel. And he looks at me and he says, you're an idiot. And I'm like, why? And he says to me, you're an unknown author. We just got you on the list. We broke you out. We got you up there. And you're going to go do that? And I had this moment where I could either stand up for what I believed in and be strong, or I could cave. And I caved faster than anyone in the history of caving. I mean, it was hard. I mean, yes, sir. Right. Yep. Check. You know, goodbye. All the ideas I want are gone. And I kept it in the back of my head. And, you know, I barely paid off my loans from college at that point. I couldn't risk it all right there. I still have my first book, which had 24 rejection letters. And to be clear, there are only 20 publishers in publishing. I had 24 rejection letters, which means some people are writing you twice to make sure you get the point. So now I'm on the book tour for The Book of Fate, the last novel, 2 years ago. And I'm in Sarasota, Florida. And which means it's just a lot of crazy Jews. That's basically what it means. Okay, that's what Sarasota, Florida means. And I'm in this room, and this can only happen. I ask for questions, and a woman stands up. You know, this only happens in Florida. And she says, "I know more about Superman than you'll ever know." And I'm like, "That's a great question, ma'am. Thank you very much." And I'm thinking to myself, "Lady, there's no way you know more about Superman than I do." And she says to me, "No, I do, because Jerry Siegel, who created Superman, is my uncle." And you'd think at that moment I would take notice of that and say, "Oh, that's cool." But I don't really even consciously register it until another man at the same signing stands up a minute later and says, "I was in the army with Jerry Siegel." It's true. And now I'm like, every Jew that ever knew Jerry Siegel is at this signing in Sarasota, Florida. And finally, when someone else does that, it's like a meteor in the back of my head. I'm like, okay, I got to pay attention here. And I take down her number. I take down his number. And when I call her, she tells me she's the first one to tell me this story. The story that almost nobody knows, because in 50 years of interviews, when they ask Jerry Siegel, "Where'd you get the idea for Superman?" he never once says, "My father died in a crime." Never says it. His father dies in a crime, and a couple weeks later, he creates the world's greatest crime fighter, but never mentions this to anybody. And that's why the world got Superman. Not because America is the greatest country on earth, but because a little boy lost his father. And I was obsessed with this story. It is a real-life murder, real-life robbery that it happened in. Half the family is told that it's a shooting. The other half of the family is told that it's a heart attack. I find the death certificate, which proves once and for all, yes, it was a heart attack. When I bring it to a forensic specialist, he says, "Well, that's interesting. It says it's a heart attack, but," and this is just my hypothesis, Brad, "but a 22, which was the popular gun in one of the popular guns in the Depression, because it was cheap and it was easy to carry, would actually leave a wound, depending on how far he was away, that would look like a heart attack." I'm just obsessed. I'm so obsessed. I will admit, I'm thinking to myself, maybe I am playing a little bit of nerd Freud here. You know, maybe I'm connecting dots that shouldn't be connected. So I fly back to Cleveland, and I look in the old issues of The Plain Dealer. And I'm thinking, you know, I want to see what Jerry Siegel is reading the day after his dad dies. Let me just see. Maybe there's something in the paper that sparked his imagination. So I'm going through all the old microfiche. I don't know why I'm making this hand motion when it's microfiche, but basically, I'm going through the microfiche. I'm like, wah, 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 and I look, and this is a day after his dad dies, and there is a letter to the editor that is written about why vigilantes should not exist in society. And it's signed A.L. Luther, like Lex Luthor. It's spelled E-R instead of O-R. I'm like, is this what we get Lex Luthor from? And this is an incredible story. I mean, no one's ever found this because no one is as big a loser as me and cares. But I care. I love this stuff. And I'm just, again, throw myself into it. I put all my resource skills that I feel like I have that I'm going to solve this crime. And I know that I'm going to use this in the thriller because I find it fascinating. And I hope that what I love translates into something that someone else would love. I don't think I'm that special. I think we all laugh at the same stuff and we hate the same stuff in many ways. And I love the story, but to me, it's still just, even as a Superman story, it's too geeky even for me, and that's saying something. And I think it's just missing something. It's just a cold case. Nothing more. No great theme. I don't know really what it says about all of us. I feel part of it, but I remember that old Cain and Abel story that for 11 years is marinated in the back of my brain. And a friend of mine says to me, "You know the story of Adam and Eve and the apple?" And I say, "Sure." And he says, "Well, that's interesting because the word apple doesn't appear in the Bible." So what are you talking about? He says, if you actually look at the real translations, it says actually fruit, probably a fig, some say a pomegranate. And the word apple was added by the Greeks in ancient Greece when they translated the Bible into Greek. Apples were a sign of destruction, and that's where the word apple entered the Bible. And then he said, how did Cain kill Abel? What was the murder weapon that Cain used? And I said, oh, it was a rock. And he says, where does it say that in the Bible? The Bible story of Cain and Abel is 16 lines long. It's one of the shortest in the Bible. And all it says is that Cain slew his brother. So some say that Cain killed Abel with a rock or a stone. Others say, including Shakespeare, that it was the jawbone of an animal. Rembrandt painted something that said the same thing. Some say that Cain bit Abel's throat, and that's where we get vampires from. That is really cool to me. Okay? I love that stuff. I hear that. I'm like, I am in. I want to know. And then I find my favorite little detail, which is I start going through these old stories. Some of the best things you actually can't find on Google because they haven't been digitized yet. These writings from the Middle Ages just haven't been put in there. So you have to, of all things, imagine this for a moment, gasp, exclamation point, go to a real library. And I went there and found this theory that said if you look at a modern Bible today, depending on what version you have, it'll say something to the effect of, Cain looks up at God and says, my punishment is too great to bear. And that's why we all think Cain is awful, because he says, I killed my brother. Why are you punishing me so much? But you can just as easily, when you look at some of the old fragments that were found centuries ago in ancient Egypt, translate that same exact section as, my sin is too great to forgive. And now Cain is saying to God, what I've done is so horrible, God, you should not forgive me. And that's a very different version of Cain than the one we all know. And now the theory is that maybe, just maybe, Cain is not the bad guy in this story. Maybe this story is not about vengeance or fratricide or killing your brother or anything else, but it's about God's capacity for forgiveness. And so now I have this one murder with Cain that says maybe he's not the bad guy in the story. I have this one other murder with Superman that says that Superman, a character that's founded and known for his strength, is actually created in a moment of vulnerability. And not to compare biblical characters and comic book characters, but these are the great stories of our time. And these stories persist for a reason. It's not just because we find them interesting or we like guys with red capes who wear their underwear on the outside of their pants. We love these stories because they say something about us. And that's why I love these stories. And I realized the themes immediately for me got much bigger. And that's where the Book of Lies was really born. So with that said, as an intro, I'd love to read a quick, very short chapter from the Book of Lies. I'm going to start with chapter 2, and I'll give you a little bit of background on it so you don't have to read it in the next 3 seconds. All you need to know is that Cal, the main character in the book, in the opening scene, he's 9 years old. He's a little kid. And we see as he watches, when he was 9 years old, his mother and father are fighting in the kitchen, and one pushes the other, and his father accidentally kills his mother. So you could tell this is a very uplifting tale, totally appropriate for the small children in the back. This is chapter 2 of the Book of Lies. My name is Cal Harper. This is the second most important day of my life. Remove him, the manager of the French bistro calls out behind us. Sorry, Cal, my client Alberto apologizes, his body shaking as I help him hobble back toward our van. From the stench on his breath, Alberto's been drinking. From his fresh split lip, plus the tear in his ratty t-shirt, he's been fighting too. Welcome to Fort Lauderdale Beach. Just another day in paradise. You planning on helping here? I call to Roosevelt, who's reclining in the passenger seat of our dumpy white van. I'm mentoring, Roosevelt calls back. No, you're sitting on your rear while I do all the work, I tell him. What do you think mentoring is, he asks, lumbering out like an old mountain cat. You got him, I ask, as I hand him Alberto. Isn't that why God put me on this planet, Roosevelt says, his dyed black aging hippie ponytail flapping in the salty ocean breeze. At 42, Roosevelt's old enough to know better than the ponytail. But we all have our weaknesses. Man, Alberto, you reek. To the few passing tourists still walking the beach, we probably look like mobsters. But our job's far more dangerous than that. Listen, thanks for calling us instead of the cops, I tell the restaurant manager, a middle-aged guy who looks like a ferret. I'm no schmuck, he laughs, dropping his French accent. Cops would take 2 hours. You take out the trash fast. He offers a handshake, and as I reach to take it, I spot a $100 bill in his palm. I pull back as if he's offering a coiled snake. Just our way of saying thanks, he adds. I don't shake back. Do you understand what I do? I ask, my thick Adam's apple pumping with each syllable. Aw, geez, you're going to give me some self-important speech now, aren't you? He asks. No speech, I tell him, but we take the homeless to shelters. And what, he interrupts. If you accept a tip, it'll make it less of a good deed. I respect that, I do, but come on. Be fair to yourself, he says, motioning to my faded black t-shirt. What are you, 30 years old with that baby face? You're wearing secondhand sneakers and sweatpants. To work. When was the last time you got a haircut? And come on, look at your van. I glance back at our van's peeling tinted windows and the swarm of rust along the back fender. Take the money, kid, he says. If you don't use it for yourself, at least help your organization. I shake my head. You called our client trash. To my surprise, he doesn't get defensive or mad. You're right, I'm sorry, he says, still holding out the money. Let this be my apology, please. Don't make it the end of the world. I stare at my sweatpants, calculating all of the underwear and socks I could buy for our clients. Come on, bro, he says. Even Bob Dylan did an iPod commercial. What the fudge, Cal? You didn't take the money, did you? Roosevelt asks as I climb back into the van. Why are you so stubborn? Same reason you say dumb crap like what the fudge. That's different. It's not different, I shoot back. You were a minister, so you don't like to curse. I get it. But it's a choice you make on principle, Roosevelt. You were a minister, Alberto blurts from the back seat. I thought you were some special agent who got fired. Twisting the ignition and hitting the gas, I don't say a word. That was Cal who was the special agent, Roosevelt points out, as we take off down A1A. Ask Cal why he got fired, Roosevelt adds. Losing his badge, you know, that's what turned his hair white, he says, pointing at my full head of thick silver hair. Nuh-uh, Alberto says. You didn't get that from your mom or daddy? I click my front teeth together, staring out at the closed tourist tea shops that line the beach. The only thing I got from my parents was a light blue government form with the charges against my father. My dad got 8 years at Glades Correction Institution. The state of Florida gave me 6 minutes to say goodbye. I remember the room smelled like spearmint gum and hairspray. Life is filled with trap doors. I happened to swan dive through mine when I was 9 years old. That was the last time I ever saw my father. Gah, Roosevelt shouts, his ruddy features burning bright. You should have taken that restaurant money. Roosevelt, the only reason he was offering that cash was so when he goes home tonight, he doesn't feel nearly as guilty for sweeping away the homeless guy that he thought was bad for his fake French bistro business. So go pray or send an email to heaven or do whatever you do to let your God weigh in. But I'm telling you, we're here to help those who need it, not to give fudging penance. His lips purse at my use of the G word. Roosevelt will joke about anything. His long hair, his obsession with early chubby Janet Jackson, so much better than the later thinner model. Even his love of your mama's so fat jokes is a tool for changing the subject during an awkward social situation. But he'll never joke about God. Cal, you know what your problem is? You're a damn walrus, Roosevelt says. When it's walking on land, walruses are the most lumbering, awkward creatures God ever gave us. But the moment it enters the water, that sucker is quicksilver. Foom, he says, slicing his hand through the air like a ski jump. Same with you, Cal. When you're working with clients, you're in the water. Foom, just quicksilver. The problem is, all you want to do is stay underwater. And even the walrus knows if it doesn't come up for air, it's going to die. That's a very inspiring and far too visual analogy, I tell him. But I know who I am, and I like who I am, and when it comes to ass-faced restaurant managers who treat money as some green-colored rosary, well, no offense, but I'm not for sale, and you of all people shouldn't be either. Roosevelt leans back in his reclined seat and lets out a hearty laugh. Your mama's so fat. Roosevelt, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said that. The horse on her polo shirt is real. You used that last week, I tell him. Your mama's so fat in elevators, it says maximum occupancy, 12 patrons, or your mama. Does that really make you happier, I ask him. Just take the money next time, Cal. Roosevelt says as he twists a dial on the old stolen police scanner that we have superglued to the dash. We have 86 requesting nearby units to Victoria Park, a woman's voice says as the scanner crackles to life. The park is less than a mile away. Turns out this is the call I'd been waiting 19 years for. Cal, I need help, Roosevelt screams. Rosie, what the hell's going on? I yell back, sticking my head out the window and squinting into the darkness. He's kneeling over our newest homeless client who's curled at the base of a queen palm tree. It's a bad one, Cal. He's a bleeder. A ping of rain hits the windshield and I jump at the impact. If this were my first day on the job, I'd leap out of the van and rush like a panicked child to Roosevelt's side. But this isn't day one. It's year two. You got a social, I call out. Kneeling at the base of the queen palm, Roosevelt tucks his flashlight under his armpit and rolls what looks like a heavy-set man onto his back. Even from here, I can see the blood that soaks the man's stomach. His wallet's gone, Roosevelt shouts. Sir, sir, can you hear me? I need your social security number. In my left hand, I'm already dialing 911. In my right, I prop my laptop on the center console, but I never take my eyes off Roosevelt. Breast cancer took my aunt, the aunt who raised me a few years back. I don't have many friends. I have this job, and I have Roosevelt. Cal, I got a social, Roosevelt shouts. Sir, were you mugged? You have a gunshot wound. Give me one sec, I call out. The computer hums, our tracking software loads, and I click on the button marked Find Client. On screen, a blank form opens, and I tab over to the section labeled Social Security Number. Cal, you need to hurry, Roosevelt adds as the man whispers something. Ready, I insist, all set to type with one hand. In my other, I grip my cell and hit send as the 911 line starts ringing. 07805-1120, Roosevelt announces as I key in the man's Social Security number. In my ear, the 911 line continues to ring. In the distance, refusing to wait, Roosevelt rips open the man's shirt and starts applying pressure to his wound. And on screen, I get my first good look at our newest client. Lloyd Randall Harper, Dania Beach, Florida. Date of birth, June 19th, 53 years old. A swell of heat burns my chest, my throat. I can't breathe. I open my mouth to call Roosevelt's name, but my lips won't move. Lloyd Randall Harper, my father. This is 911, the operator announces in my ear. What's your emergency? Ooh, scary. That's it. So a couple of things that I think are important to talk about. One is you will also see under my ridiculous author photo where I'm wearing the same exact thing I'm wearing now is there is an offer in the back of your book for a soundtrack for the Book of Lies. Does a novel need a soundtrack? No, it does not. Is it cool to have a soundtrack? Yes, it is absolutely cool to have one. And it is especially cool because I got to use my years of mixmaster skills, making mixes that I thought would somehow get me in bed with somebody, with great titles like Bell Biv DeMeltz, Please Melts Don't Hurt Him, Melty Soul, and the infamous Melty Fresh, which had a little too much Keith Sweat, not enough Prince, but that was the way it went. And the best part is when you do your soundtrack, you get to pick the songs. So I got to pick, with my great taste in music, one of my favorite songs ever, the theme from The Greatest American Hero TV show. A fine, fine song, right? And I go to Sony and I say, this is what I would like for our soundtrack. And they say, well, that's fine, but Warner Brothers owns those rights. We don't own those rights. And I remember that Stephen J. Cannell, who created The Greatest American Hero and The A-Team and my childhood, is basically a novelist, is also a fellow novelist, a good novelist, great novelist. And I know someone who knows him. And so I call him up and I say, listen, they told me that Warner Brothers owns the rights and Sony doesn't own the rights. And he says, oh, no, what are you talking about? Warner Brothers doesn't own the rights. I said, who owns them? He says, I do. And then I said, can I have them? And he says, sure. And so we get the Greatest American Hero theme, and that's cool to me. It's also cool that we got REM. That's pretty cool to me. And the number one thing that is cool to me is we have a song, an original song on there called The Book of Lies. Someone read the book and wrote a song called The Book of Lies. I don't care if it's the worst song on this entire planet. That's the greatest song of all time to me. And you can download it and listen to it. It's on, you know, iTunes and on Amazon, and you know, it's just all digital download only. But the one thing that I do love about the soundtrack is that we also did a score for the book. And what Sony did is the same department that does scores for their movies scored the book and read through and picked the key chapters of the book, like the one I just read, like chapter 7, like these other chapters, and it sent me all this list of all the songs that should apply. I actually threw away half their music, and then we fought and argued and actually got along very well and came up with other ones. But you can play... read those chapters and hit play on your iPod, and you can hear the song that goes with that chapter, and you can hear the mood. And the closest thing I can give you to hearing that mood and that song that's in my head as I write it, and that is pretty cool to me. If you download just one, save it for the last chapter. That is, to me, the pitch-perfect song to go with the exact last chapter of the book, and I really am proud of that one. The other thing I do want to talk about is the Superman house, the house where Superman was created. And when I was researching the novel, it was very important to me to go out and see this house. You know, this is the place where Superman was created. This is where Jerry Siegel sat up in bed one night in Cleveland, Ohio, and said, I have an idea. And so I went there, and I figured it would be like something out of a Norman Rockwell painting, that there would be, you know, hot apple pie steaming on the front steps. And the house where Google was founded is protected, but the house where Superman was created is a mess. And I don't mean it just needs some paint. I mean it's a wreck. There's holes in the walls and holes in the ceiling. And there's this great couple who lives there. And she even said to me, she said, you know what, Brad? You know that Cleveland, Ohio will not even give us a plaque, not even a plaque, to say that Superman was created in this house. And I said to her, I'm going to get you your plaque. And I said to her, I'm going to be back. And I didn't know really what that meant. It was just a macho thing to say in a moment of anger, you know. But I was like, I'm going to be back. And gave her the finger like that. And, you know. And I left. And I started calling people. I called people in the entertainment industry, in the comic book industry. And I believe ordinary people change the world. I don't care where you went to school. I don't care how much money you make. That is nonsense. I believe in regular people. I believe in people like Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, who were so poor that they used to draw on the back of wallpaper, and they gave us the great idea that is known as Superman. And I really believe that that's how movements get started, is because regular, ordinary people get involved. So we got Stephen Colbert to donate tickets to his show. We got the TV show Heroes to donate a walk-on part. If you're the high bidder in this auction, this charitable auction we're doing, you can be on the TV show Heroes. We got the greatest artist who draws Superman today to draw the character, and we put it all in the auction. I should also tell you, ending on Monday, if you want to be a character in my next novel, you can bid on that too. I'm not doing it for free anymore. No more. That's over. Now you got to pay for it. But you'll see. All the money goes to save the Superman house. All the money goes to the charity. We have T-shirts that Chip Kidd, the great designer, designed. And we have people over and over who are giving $10, $20. And it is just so reaffirming to me that that's how this is going to happen. It's not the government that's going to do it. It's not big business that's going to do it. It's just regular, ordinary people. And I realized after 2 years of researching Superman that Superman is not the best part of the story. The best part of the story is Clark Kent. Why? Because we're all Clark Kent. We all know what it's like to be ordinary and boring and wish we could rip open our shirt and help somebody. And that is what this house and what we're doing for it stands for. So I really would appreciate if you go take a look. Go buy something for yourself. I don't care what it is, but I'm really proud of it. And with that said, let me say this. This is now, I think, my 6th time back here for my 7th novel that I've been out here for, and there are a lot of faces that I know in this audience now, and they're not just the people that I know who come here. They're people who come year after year. Every time I'm here, you come year after year, and I hope you know how much that matters, especially this year. This is an emotional year for me, everything that happened, and there are a lot of people here who have written emails, sent condolences, and even just said, I'm going to go out there and get the next book. That matters. So thank you for taking your time, especially on a night that's cold and starting to rain when it's so easy to sit and say, you know, forget this. I really appreciate it. The other thing is, thanks for coming here to Tattered Cover. Every time you buy a book, you vote. You vote for what you want. And I know that, listen, I go to every bookstore in the country, every big independent, great independent store. You, of course, know that this is one of the treasures you have. But thank you for supporting this bookstore. And when you're thinking about where should I go, I can go here or there, come here. It's a great store. And I really appreciate you coming here tonight. So I'm happy to sign books. I'm happy to sign comics. For those who brought like stacks of comics like this, I'm happy to do those too. Just do like 10 at a time and then get back in line so we don't hold everybody up. Listen, I'm feeling a little randy tonight. I'll sign some Mary Higgins Clark too if you want. So thanks again for coming. I really appreciate it.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for Douglas Brown, Chuck Klosterman, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on September 11th, 2008.